The National Broadcasting Company presents the third in a series of 8 radio dramas by George H. Faulkner entitled American Portraits. Tonight's star, Alan Hewitt.
Order! Order, please! Order! Order, please. It is here further charged that the defendants, William Williams, William McCauley, Matthew Kilroy, Hugh Montgomery, James Hartigan, Hugh White, William Warren, and John Carroll, not having the fear of God before their eyes, but being moved and seduced by the instigation of the devil in their own wicked hearts, did on the 5th day of March, with force and arms, feloniously, willfully, and of their malice aforethought, do unto death the aforesaid 5 citizens of Boston Town. The prisoners have heard the indictment. How do they plead?
Not guilty.
God send you a good deliverance. Let the trial proceed.
This is the story of a famous American murder trial. And it is told by the attorney for the defense, for it is his story, too. His name, John Adams. That same John Adams who was one day to become the second president of the United States. John Yankee himself. John Adams speaks.
They were innocent under our law, those 8 British soldiers, and I knew it. Yet to plead their cause in the year 1770 was the most difficult task I ever undertook in a lifetime full of stony choices. I think the story might well begin on an early summer evening 2 years before the trial. Abigail and I had a late visitor at our house in Brattle Street, my closest friend, Jonathan Sewell. I had offered him a glass of Madeira.
Ah, excellent, John. An excellent wine.
Where did you get it, Abby? Some of John Hancock's contraband treasure, the wine of liberty.
Now, Mr. Sewell, no politics, please.
Oh, nonsense, my dear Abby. I may be a king's man, but my political convictions do not extend to smuggled Madeira. In a vintage so fine, I'll drink to either party.
I wish I could view our present troubles so lightly, Jonathan.
Alas, and the king's tax on Hancock's wine. That's an abomination, eh?
It is an unjust tax. I hate injustice.
Oh, John, John, my friend. When will you ever learn to unbend a little? Can't you teach him, Abigail?
I care not to try, Mr. Sewell. I not want to try, sir.
No, perhaps I can make the attempt. We'll see. I have news for you, John.
Yes, I thought you might, by the gleam in your eye. Abby, would you mind?
I was about to see to the children, John. Good night, Mr. Sewell. You will not succeed. My husband does not bend easily.
We'll see, we'll see. Oh, good night, dear lady. You'll kiss little Abby good night for me and John Quincy, too.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Well, John?
Well, Jonathan?
I won't beat about the bush, my old friend. I've been sent by Governor Bernard and Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson to offer you the post of Advocate General in the King's Admiralty Court.
What?
Now, don't bridle and draw back like an offended maiden. It means your fortune is made, man.
It means I should sit in judgment on my friends who have avoided the King's tax and grow rich upon their substance.
It means new friends, John. Powerful friends. Friends who have the ear of the king himself. Who are your precious friends now, these so-called Sons of Liberty, penniless adventurers?
John Hancock, James Otis, Dr. Warren, Ben Edes of the Gazette, my cousin Samuel. Some of the most substantial men in the colony.
Oh, Sam Adams is a dockside demagogue, a tattered ne'er-do-well troublemaker. The others, well, exceptions perhaps, that prove the rule. You are an ambitious lawyer, John. Your future lies with the king's party. It's court against country. The court will win.
Jonathan, you too are my friend. I have none closer or more dear. So you must have known my answer would be no. I cannot change my political principles.
But His Excellency called that point to my attention most emphatically. He told me to tell you that your political convictions will be no obstacle. No obstacle whatever. He offers the post simply because you are the best man available. He told me to say that he depends on your faith.
It was a bribe, and I knew it. An attempt to break the ranks of the royal governor's opponents. But I couldn't accuse my old friend of trying to bribe me, or of supposing I could be bribed. We talked late and long. He made me promise to consult my wife. And when he had gone, I found Abby waiting at our bedroom window. I told her, and she said,
"Yes, John, it is a bribe. Of course it is."
A tempting bribe, a good price, easy to take.
Yes, and there would be other honors to come. You could be Chief Justice, Sir John Adams. The court's party fears you, John.
Do you want me to take the post, my dear?
Are you testing me, John? You know that's not necessary. Just as I know you'll always refuse such offers. John... Oh, John, doesn't it make you proud to be so feared by the great ones, by the king's men?
It does. It does indeed. And to be loved by such a wise and lovely lady as well, there's a gift no king could offer.
My, Jonathan was wrong. You can unbend on the proper occasions. Listen, the watchman must be very late.
All is well, but a storm is brewing in Boston town. A blow to put the stars out. Somehow, Abby, somehow I'm afraid I rejoice in the coming storm. And I hate it, too.
'Twill clear the air. There'll be brighter stars ahead, I think.
All men knew that trouble was near in Massachusetts. There were thousands of British soldiers quartered upon us in Boston, and the king's taxes threatened the livelihood of every man. A powder keg. Yes, a powder keg with a long fuse. Among the Sons of Liberty, there were those who counseled moderation. I was one of them. And there were the firebrands. My cousin Sam was their leader. I remember he said,
"John, we're proud of you to stand fast and refuse a certain fortune as you did."
But how did you know? Jonathan Sewell told no one but me.
The Sons of Liberty have ways of knowing. We have informants in the very council chamber of the governor. Your loyalty will be rewarded, cousin, in the future.
If I thought of rewards, I'd have taken the post. And if you take my advice, Sam, you'll move more slowly. If violence must come, let it not be said that we began the open quarrel.
Tread softly, John. Walk quietly under the yoke.
I say but this. Break no law. The law is my guide.
The law, yes, and your stiff-necked, stubborn honesty. I admire you, John, but we're different as night and day. You ask me to hold back the inevitable thunder, to stem the very tide of great events. The Sons of Liberty are prepared to seize the tide at the flood and move on. For freedom and glory. Now we wait upon events, to be sure. But perhaps we can shape events a little, or more than a little. The flood tide, cousin, is almost here. The time to tread softly has passed.
The life of Boston in our day moved to a pleasing music, the music of bells. The bells of Christ's Church, of New North, the King's Chapel, of the brick church with its cockerel weather vane. They told us the time, and the times were out of joint. They called us to prayer, and we prayed, often and long for peace. But now the bells were to make a new sound, a savage sound. Alarm bells ringing in the night as for fire. For the flood tide had come, as Cousin Sam had said it would. In London, Lord North, the King's first minister, had sneered, "The drunken ragamuffins of a vociferous mob are in America exalted into equal importance with men of judgment, morals, and property. I can never acquiesce in the absurd opinion that all men are equal." And in Boston, a customs informer was tarred and feathered. In Boston, a vociferous mob of ragamuffins threw snowballs and stones through the windows of a tax collector. He seized a musket, fired upon them. They fell back, and in the cleared space, a lad lay dead. For little Chris Snyder's funeral, all the bells rang out. Samuel Adams saw to that. In a waterfront rope walk at lunch hour, soldiers and workmen exchanged obscenities, and unforgivable blows were struck. The next morning, the day being March 5th in the year 1770, a poster appeared, tacked up in a dockside tavern. It read, "This is to inform the rebellious people in Boston that the soldiers in the 14th and 29th regiments are determined to join together and defend themselves against all who shall oppose them. Signed, the soldiers of the 14th and 29th Regiments." Who posted that notice? Was it truly the soldiers? Or might it have been that mysterious gentleman in the red cloak and white wig who was everywhere on that fatal day? No one will ever know. But as night falls, strolling crowds of Liberty Boys begin to fill the streets. A barber's apprentice insults a sentinel. The sentinel gives chase, whacks the boy with the butt of his musket. Snowballs and ice begin to fill the air. Then oyster shells, sharp, dangerous as razor blades. As if on signal, the fire bells break out.
Kill that soldier!
Kill the lobster! Kill him! Kill him!
Come on, boys!
Lobster! Kill my lobster!
Red cloak and the white wig is everywhere, urging on the rioters. Captain Preston, commanding the guard, brings seven men to rescue the sentinel. The crowd presses in. Crispus Attucks swings a big birch club. One of the soldiers is hit by an oyster shell, slips on the ice, falls. His gun goes off in the air. There is no order to fire. But this is the high tide. Here is the powder and here is the flint. This is the inevitable hour. And the spark is struck. Three were dead. Two were mortally wounded. Quickly, the red-clad regiments poured into the streets, bayonets gleaming in the moonlight. The alarm bells ceased as suddenly as they had begun. By 3 a.m, Boston was quiet again. Next day, I found Cousin Sam and Ben Edes, editor of the Gazette, waiting for me at my office.
John, we need your advice, as ever it seems.
It may be too late now, Ben. I see the streets are filling up with armed men. Where is Captain Preston? Where are the soldiers of the guard?
In the Stone Jail. They've been charged with murder, but with the farmers coming in...
The prisoners are in danger, yes. Cousin... You'll not carry this thing further.
No, John, enough is enough. The farm lads are flocking in looking for trouble.
Tell them to go home. And tell me this. Who was the man in the red cloak and white wig, Sam?
Cousin, I'll thank you not to peer down your great nose at me in that fashion. This is my only cloak, and it's black, rusty, and threadbare enough, as you see.
Ben, see who that is and look through the window.
That's Mr. Forrester, the man they call the Irish Infant, a friend of Captain Preston.
Let him in, Ben.
Mr. Adams. Oh, thanks be to God and his angels I found you in. Man's is a terrible thing.
What is your business, Mr. Forrester?
I come from Captain Preston, sir. He's in great danger. He and his men will be tried at once for murder itself, and there's no one to defend them. No one, sir. All the great Tory lawyers have refused the case for fear of their precious necks. Captain Preston wants you to defend him.
As God is my witness, John Adams, these men are innocent. They but saved their own skins in the night.
Yes, they are innocent. They acted in self-defense.
John! John, you can't do this.
I can, and I will.
You're a good man, John Adams. Sure, there's greatness in your soul.
John, my friend and my cousin, you'll ruin your career. By refusing the governor's bribe, you lost all royal favor. By doing this thing, you'll be cursed forever by the men of your own belief. You risk your very life. Don't do it, John.
The men are innocent. They cannot be denied a defender. Mr. Edes.
Yes, John.
In the Gazette today, you will kindly announce that John Adams will defend the King's soldiers now lying in jail under capital charges. Come along, Forrester. We'll talk with the prisoners. Our first move was to get a postponement of trial, to let the passions of my fellow townsmen cool a bit. Young Josiah Quincy was my associate in the case, and together we had little trouble freeing Captain Preston. There had clearly been no order to fire that night. But the 8 private soldiers, that was indeed a different matter.
Listen to this, Mr. Adams, one of the 94 depositions collected by your cousin Sam. On the night of March 5th, I, Samuel Atwood, met 10 or 12 soldiers armed with drawn cutlasses and bayonets. Your opponent asked if they meant to murder people. They answered, yes, by gad, root and branch, and we'll start with you.
Enough, Josiah. 94 witnesses and 94 liars.
I doubt that all of them will venture into court, sir.
A great number of them will. We must scour the streets and docks for men who will tell the truth. We must prepare to refute each deposition of the 94. We must find honest men, if such there be. We found 60 Bostonians calm enough to remember what actually happened that night. When the trial began, we had 96 against us. One by one, they took the stand, day in, day out. Lying, lying, lying.
I say Private Kilroy's bayonet was thick with dried blood up to 3 inches from the point. 3 inches of blood. I saw it with my own eyes. 3 bloody inches.
And that, one way or another, was what they all said. Then our turn came. Hour by hour, the truth piled up on the word of witness after witness. Finally, Dr. Jeffries took the stand, the physician who had attended Patrick Carr, one of the slain citizens in his dying hours. Josiah Quincy was examining.
Now, Dr. Jeffries, you visited young Carr, the innocent bystander, after he was injured.
I did, Mr. Quincy, yes.
What did you say to him?
After dressing his wounds, I advised him never again to go into quarrels and riots.
And what did he say?
He agreed I had a good case there. He told me also that he was a native of Ireland, that he'd frequently seen mobs and soldiers called upon to quell them. He said more.
Go on, Doctor.
He said that never in all his life had he seen soldiers bear so much abuse before they fired upon a mob.
Well, there you are, you see.
Order! Order, please! Proceed, Mr. Quincy.
How long did Patrick Carr live after he received his wound?
10 days, almost to the minute.
And when had you a last conversation with him?
About 4 o'clock in the afternoon of the day he died.
And what did this dying boy say to you?
He said, I forgive the man who shot me, whoever he is. As God will judge me soon, that soldier fired only to save himself from certain death.
Then, with a prayer in my heart that our months of toil might have just reward, I heard the presiding judge declare,
Mr. John Adams will sum up the cause of the defendants.
May it please your honors, and you, gentlemen of the jury. I am for the prisoners at the bar, and shall apologize for it only in the words of a great Italian jurist, the Marquis of Beccaria.
If I can be but the instrument of preserving one life, his blessing upon my head shall be a sufficient consolation to me for the contempt of all mankind. As the prisoners stand before you for their lives, it may be proper to recollect with what temper the law requires that we should proceed to this trial, that the spirit of the law upon such occasions is conformable to humanity, to common sense and feeling. Place yourselves in the situation of Kilroy or the sentry, with the fire bells ringing, and you know well there is no fire, the people shouting and making the mob whistle, as they call it, and crying, kill them, kill them, and heaving snowballs, oyster shells, clubs, heavy birch sticks. Consider yourselves in this situation, and then judge if a reasonable man would not consider they were going to kill him. The law reads, he who on an assault retreats to the wall beyond which he can go no further before he kills the other is judged to act upon unavoidable necessity.
Phew. How long has he been talking now?
Since 11 o'clock yesterday morning. It's 4 o'clock almost now, nearly 12 hours yesterday and today.
How does it look?
I think he'll get him off. He's a fine man.
Oh, he's a great man. Let's see if we can get inside again to hear him finish up. He can't talk much longer now.
The law no passion can disturb. It is void of desire and fear, lust and anger. It is written reason, retaining some measure of the divine perfection. It commands that which is good and punishes evil in all, whether rich or poor, high or low. Tis deaf, inexorable, inflexible. So Sidney wrote. The law here, on the one hand, is inexorable to the cries and lamentations of these prisoners. On the other, it is deaf. Deaf as an adder to the clamors of the populace. Gentlemen of the jury, to your candor and justice, I submit the prisoners and their cause.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
And what is your verdict?
William Williams, James Hartigan, William McCauley, Hugh White, William Warren, and John Carroll, not guilty. Matthew Kilroy and Hugh Montgomery, not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter.
Your Honor, on behalf of the two defendants, Kilroy and Montgomery, proved guilty of manslaughter, I ask the benefit of clergy.
It is granted, Mr. Adams. They will be set free after they've been branded in the thumb with fire. It is our usage that this be done at once. The bailiff will prepare the fire and the iron. The court will please remain in order.
Well, Abby, it's over. Over and won. Over and done.
I'm proud of you, John.
I did what I had to do. But what now? My day in the courts of this colony is over. Would you like to be a poor farmer's wife, Abby?
I'd be quite content. But I don't believe that would be necessary. You won a greater victory than you suppose, my dear.
I saved the lives of 8 innocent men. That's enough. I made 12 good men and true see the right and declare it.
That's quite enough.
But you did more. You won the minds and the hearts and the goodwill of the people of Massachusetts. Perhaps the people are wiser than you think, John. They'll not make you suffer for having upheld their own law so well.
And by God's grace and her own wisdom, Abby was right. A few years later, I wrote in my diary, "There is a new and grand scene open before me, a Congress. This will be an assembly of the wisest men upon the continent who are Americans in principle." I had been elected to that Congress by the people of Massachusetts. And the bells of Boston rang in celebration as we set out for Philadelphia, with Cousin Samuel and me reunited again in the great cause of liberty, and on the cushions of a fine coach. Sam, that's a fine red cloak you're wearing.
You like it, Cousin? 'Twas given me just last week by the Sons of Liberty. They thought I might well appear less shabby than usual when we meet with the Virginian grandees.
Tis most becoming. My, my, silk stockings. And golden knee buckles, too. Ah, but it's the cloak I most admire. You're quite sure it is a new one, Cousin?
Oh, yes, Cousin, quite sure. You see, I always wanted a red cloak.
And a white wig, Sam?
To be sure, John, I have it in my trunk. It's new enough. Drive more slowly, boy. The people wish to see us.
And to round off the story, I must tell you that we made our first stop at Falmouth, where I called upon Jonathan Sewell, for he was still my friend.
John, John, I had thought you were won over to the King's party when you defended those soldiers, but now...
Now there's no turning back until the end.
The end can be most unpleasant, John.
I've never avoided unpleasantness in the pursuit of principle.
No, no, you haven't. With you, John, honesty is a disease.
Perhaps. But those 8 soldiers are glad I'm ailing in such a manner.
This time, old friend, you've tackled a case you can never win. I saw you in that carriage with Sam Adams. Both of you are driving hell-bent towards a gallows tree.
That may be true. But I have crossed over my river. I've passed my Rubicon. I will never change. Swim or sink, survive or perish, I am with my country from this day on.
Our thanks to Alan Hewitt, who played John Adams. Mr. Hewitt, a featured player in the Broadway hit Call Me Madam, replaced Dennis King as our star tonight because of the sudden illness of Mr. King. Others in the cast were Miss Brooke Byron, Martin Blaine, Peter Capel, Jack Edwards, Gavin Gordon, Ronald Long, Richard Newton, and Sidney Smith. Our music is conducted by Milton Kadams and composed by Alan Shulman. Ben Gower inviting you to listen to American Portraits next week, when we will present a portrait of the great Southern leader Stonewall Jackson with one of Broadway's outstanding actors, Mr. Kent Smith, in the starring role. Tonight's program was the third in a series of 8 American Portraits produced and directed by D. Engelbach and written by George H. Faulkner. It was presented through the courtesy and cooperation of the editors of Cavalcade of America, which is heard regularly on Tuesday nights and which will resume its fall broadcasting season on September 4th. Now hear Brian Donlevy and his dangerous assignment on NBC.